senior nuclear negotiator said that the country's uranium enrichment program was stopped or slowed down prior to the removal of all the U.S. sanctions. A U.S. doctor testifying in the George Floyd murder trial says the African American's pre-existing health conditions were not relevant to his death. Also coming up, Brazil sets a new daily record of coronavirus deaths as the pandemic spreads rapidly across the country and overwhelmed hospitals run low on supplies. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, our top story this hour, Press TV has conducted an interview with Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. He said there are signals that the United States may remove all sanctions on Iran. He reiterated Iran's position that Tehran will resume its suspended commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal only if all U.S. sanctions are removed. Political commentator Omar Leon says the United States was the party that withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and should therefore be the first to resume its compliance with the agreement.
And that it was the United States that breached the OP5, that breached the agreement. The one who breached the agreement is the one that needs to come back into compliance in the agreement. So, and understanding how Iran's position is based on integrity, it is based on honesty, and there is a strong moral base to the Iranian position, then yes, I think Iran is heading down the right path. The United States is the one that withdrew from the agreement. The United States is the one that can't be trusted. So the United States is the one that needs to demonstrate not only to Iran, but demonstrate to the rest of the world that when the American government takes a position, that the American government stands behind the position that it takes.
Iran's military has pledged to respond to a recent attack on one of its vessels in the Red Sea. The Iranian Armed Forces spokesman, Brigadier General Abul Fazl Shekarchi, said Tehran needs to ascertain the source of the incident first. He added that if the source of the attack on the ship is uncovered, Iran will definitely respond and won't be silent. Shekarchi stressed that Iran cannot take a decision on what is going on to do until the investigations are concluded with utmost accuracy. He, however, noted that Tehran is considering its traditional adversaries, the United States and Israel, as well as their regional allies, to be linked to the incident. The Iranian ship was attacked on Tuesday morning off the coast of Djibouti. The attack caused minor damage to the ship. In other news, the Yemeni army says it has carried out a successful and precise retaliatory drone strike against military targets in Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari said the attack targeted warplane hangars in an airport in the southwestern city of Jizan. However, the Saudi-led coalition waging a war on its neighbor claimed it had destroyed a Yemeni explosives-laden drone fired in the direction of the Saudi city of Jizan. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have been carrying out retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia since then. They have vowed to continue the raids until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression. Yemeni activist and political commentator Hossein Abouhaiti says Yemeni retaliatory attacks have diminished the Saudi ability to carry out aerial offensives against its southern neighbor.
Just to be honest with you, this type of attack that has been targeting for the last 2 years Jizan Airport and as well Abha Airport, including as well Najran Airport, those Saudi are actually a civilian airport, but they have been used by Saudi fighter jets because they are close to the Yemeni border to target Yemen and to target civilians in Yemen. That's why when Yemeni army have started targeting those airports, we have noticed that attack and Saudi strike has been reduced into Yemen because of those attacks mainly focus on Saudi fighter jet warplane hangars, as it happened today about an hour ago, as General Sari has announced. Until now, I think that Yemeni army, they should actually extend their attack. They should target Saudi Arabia with more fighter jets. They should target their oil infrastructure, because till now, Saudi has not allowed any fuel ship to enter Hodeidah. And by using a simple app like vessel finder or marine radar app in anybody's phone, you can notice that there are about 11 oil tanker just in the middle of the Red Sea in front of Jizan port, and there is only one oil tanker has reached Hodeidah, but still is still waiting in Hodeidah port for a permission from Saudi coalition to unload its fuel.
Israel has conducted many airstrikes against Syria in the recent years. While the attacks are a clear violation of Syria's sovereignty, the Israeli regime has not been held into account by the international community. Now, Damascus has called on the United Nations to take action against Tel Aviv. During our news review program, we discussed the issue. Let's take a look.
And I welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Let's go. Damascus has called on the United Nations Security Council to take decisive and immediate measures to end Israeli strikes on Syrian territory. In a statement, the Syrian Foreign Ministry asked the UN body to hold Israel accountable for what it called the regime's terrorism and crimes against the Syrian people. This after Syria's air defenses intercepted a number of Israeli rockets over the southern parts of the capital, Damascus. Attack left four Syrian soldiers wounded and caused some material damage. Israel has repeatedly carried out strikes against Syria over the past years. Joining us now for this news review is Muhammad Ali, joining us out of Damascus, and Rick Sterling, investigative journalist, joining us out of sunny California. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Muhammad, we're going to start with you to get the latest, and if you can, Muhammad, just let us know, how many times has Syrian territory been targeted by the Israelis, and how many times has Damascus pleaded for this to get addressed in the UN Security Council to no avail?
Yes, unfortunately, we cannot count them, because Israel has been attacking Syria since almost the start of the crisis in 2011, and the foreign ministry in Syria always stresses that those attacks are in direct support of the terrorist groups on the ground in Syria. Now, the foreign ministry has been sending letters in reply to a question so many times, almost every time there's an Israeli attack, the foreign ministry sends letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General, informing them officially on what happened and calling on the international body to take measures to force Israel to stop its aggressive policy against Syria. Of course, this is a policy, and those attacks are against international law and the UN Charter itself. The foreign ministry issued a statement just following yesterday's Israeli attacks on Syria, calling on the United Nations Security Council to take immediate and decisive measures to prevent any future Israeli attacks on Syrian soil. Also, the foreign ministry underlines the necessity of punishing Israel for what it described as its terrorism, and also for the crimes committed not just against the Syrian people, but also against the Palestinian people. The foreign ministry also said that Israel should be punished for its ongoing support to terrorist groups in Syria, because all that constitutes a blatant violation of international law, UN Charter, and UN Security Council resolutions. The foreign ministry made it clear that the Israeli attacks on Syria and terrorism are primarily aiming to block the Syrian army and its allies from defeating al-Daesh, the al-Nusra Front, and other terrorist groups that are, in fact, at the end of the day, according to the foreign ministry, partners with Israel in terror.
Thank you, Mohammed. And Mr. Rick Sterling, I'd like to welcome you to the program, sir. Hope you're doing well. Your initial thoughts on, Tel Aviv gets the right. It's not mandated. It has no mandate to carry out anything on Syrian territory. And it boggles the mind that so often Damascus has pled for help and have this thing addressed, and it's not getting addressed. It boggles everyone's mind. Your initial thoughts on this, please.
Well, that's right. It does boggle our mind, but it exposes and shows and demonstrates the bias and hypocrisy of some member states of the UN Security Council. I think Syria is doing exactly the right thing by continuing to request that UN Security Council do its job, really, and intervene. The fact that they haven't done that doesn't mean that they don't need to keep doing that. I think the world, in many countries in the world, increasingly see the bias and hypocrisy of some member states of the UN Security Council, the US and the UK, for example. It's good to hear that the Syrians are getting more and more effective at shooting down the attacking missiles. I understand that most of the attacking missiles were shot down successfully. And regarding the hypocrisy of the UN Security Council and some member states, principally the United States and the UK especially, we could just imagine if Syria was to attack Tel Aviv with missiles. And of course, Israel has been attacking Syria every month or two. It seems like there's an attack taking place with people killed or injured. So it's very serious, and they need to. I'm glad they're taking it to the UN Security Council. Eventually, the tide is going to shift, and they're going to be forced to take action.
But Rick, you know, the thing is here, like, to your point, when you spend decades trying to annex a chunk of Syrian territory in the Golan Heights, when you've been doing it to Palestinians for decades, when you've killed said people when they try to stand up for their rights, then what makes you think that anyone's going to oppose when you have a U.S. veto standing behind you, your indiscriminate airstrikes over Syrian territory for the last 10 years?
Right. Well, even within Israel now, they're recognizing it's an apartheid state. That is, B'Tselem recently came out with a report officially claiming that Israel's an apartheid state. So change happens slowly, but change is happening. The world is increasingly seeing Israeli apartheid at home, occupation of not just the West Bank and Gaza, but occupation of the Golan. All that needs to change, as well as the right of return needs to be continued and insisted upon.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Do stay safe still. We'll hear from both of you again. Muhammad Ali joining us from Damascus, and Rick Sterling there joining us out of California. And thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Turning to other news now, at least one person is killed and six wounded when a gunman opened fire in central Texas in yet another mass shooting in the United States. Police said the shooting unfolded at a building with many people inside. A suspect has been taken into custody. The shooting came hours after President Joe Biden announced a series of executive actions to tackle a surge in mass shootings. The president described gun violence as an epidemic and an international embarrassment. Since mid-March, several deadly mass shootings occurred across the U.S. The rampages saw 8 people getting killed in Atlanta, 10 at a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado, and 4, including a 9-year-old boy in Orange County, California. A respiratory doctor has testified on the 9th day of the trial over George Floyd's death, saying the African-American died from a lack of oxygen. Martin Tobin told a court session that Floyd's breathing was weakened and that caused his heart to stop. He dismissed defense claims that pre-existing medical conditions may have contributed to Floyd's death. Tobin added that even after Floyd stopped breathing, white former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin continued to pin him down on the street. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges. His defense team has argued that he did only what he was trained to do in his 19 years as a police officer. 46-year-old Floyd's death sparked massive protests against police brutality and racial injustice in the United States. Political commentator John Parker says many cases like Floyd's happen across the country, but officers can get away with their actions most of the time as there is no video evidence.
The thing is that the George Floyd case, if there was no video of George Floyd, this wouldn't even be being talked about. There would be the cop, Chauvin, wouldn't even be on trial, which means to say that this happens over and over and over again, systemically over and over again, And only because it was exposed by video was the fact that this case came up. But they could have tried many other cases. And both the Democratic and Republican parties are not serious about the safety of black and brown people in this country. The only thing Biden said was maybe you should shoot them in the leg. They're not serious. And there's a reason for that. I mean, the U.S. economy is on an advanced stage of decay, and more dollars are invested in financial speculation than in production, which means the ruling class, the corporations, are very desperate to make a profit. And the only way they can make a profit is by taking more and more money from especially black and brown communities, working class communities, taking away the services and things. And when you do that, people want to fight back. They want to protest. They want to demand economic justice. And in order to stop them from doing that, you allow the police to keep them in fear. And that's what this is. It's a purposeful thing, these murders that are going on, like George Floyd, to keep us in fear so we won't fight back.
Going to turn to some coronavirus news now, beginning with Brazil, which has registered a new record in daily fatalities from COVID-19 as the pandemic is spreading rapidly across the South American country. The health ministry said more than 4,200 people have died from the disease in 24 hours. Over 86,000 have also tested positive within the same period. Brazil has registered more than 13.2 million cases since the pandemic began, while the official death toll has surpassed 345,000. Brazil is the second worst hit nation by the virus in the world after the United States in terms of both fatalities and infections. Over a year since the start of the coronavirus contagion, Europe is now firmly in the grip of the third wave of the pandemic, with infections and deaths surging in several countries. Turkey reported a record of nearly 56,000 new cases and 258 more deaths. France has also posted 85,000 daily infections, with its overall caseload edging closer to 5 million. France is the worst hit country in Europe in terms of infections. Another badly hit nation, Italy, registered more than 17,000 daily infections and confirmed almost 500 new deaths. Meanwhile, Germany saw more than 20,000 daily infections and 306 new deaths. The government says it plans to talk to Russia about buying Sputnik V vaccine if it is approved by the European Medicine Regulator. Turkey plans to impose stricter measures, meanwhile, to bring COVID-19 under control, with some even suggesting a full lockdown throughout the holy month of Ramadan. This comes as the number of daily cases has surged to almost 55,000, the highest daily count in the country since the start of the pandemic last year. Tarshan Seglem reports.
Turkey has reported an unprecedented surge of daily coronavirus cases. The new infections stood at almost 55,000 on Wednesday, as the highest in the country since the outbreak of the pandemic last year. Turkish government plans to reduce the numbers during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan to welcome tourists again after the month. Turkish president said that he wants to see a significant reduction in the number of coronavirus infections by the end of Ramadan, as he announced last week that during the holy month, restaurants and coffee shops' work will be limited to takeout and delivery services only. Meanwhile, Turkey will continue to witness a daily curfew from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. and total weekend lockdowns. Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca said earlier that 75% of the new coronavirus cases in the country are from the more contagious variant detected in Britain. This as the country is still open for tourists who are not included in the curfew and lockdown measures. Some analysts believe the latest measures is the reason behind the sudden increase in the new cases. Turkey is pressing ahead with its nationwide vaccination campaign using the Sinovac and Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine shots. So far, more than 10.55 million people have been given the first doses and 7.41 million were given the second. Turkey's announcement of a nationwide lockdown during the holy month of Ramadan has created chaos, which is seen by many as the reason behind the increasing number of daily infections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Diver. diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump's policies to check China's trade dominance are not going away anytime soon. This is one of the few issues on which Democrats and Republicans broadly agree, and there is little question that trade deglobalization undermines the U.S. dollar. Here we present you an article written by Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics and public policy at Harvard University. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Dollar's Hegemony is Looking Fragile." The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. U.S. dollar's dominance may well be more fragile than it appears, because expected future changes in China's exchange rate regime are likely to trigger a significant shift in the international monetary order. For many reasons, the Chinese authorities will probably someday stop pegging their renminbi to a basket of currencies and shift to a modern inflation-targeting regime under which they allow the exchange rate to fluctuate much more freely, especially against the U.S. dollar. When that happens, expect most of Asia to follow China. In due time, the dollar, currently the anchor currency for roughly two-thirds of the world's gross domestic product or GDP, could lose nearly half of its weight. Considering how much the United States relies on the dollar's special status, or what then-French Finance Minister Valérie Giscard d'Estaing famously called America's exorbitant privilege to fund massive public and private borrowing, the impact of such a shift could be significant. Given that the United States has been aggressively using deficit financing to combat the economic ravages of COVID-19, the sustainability of its debt might be called into question. The long-standing argument for a more flexible Chinese currency is that China is simply too big to let its economy dance to the U.S. Federal Reserve's tune, even if Chinese capital controls provide some measure of insulation. China's gross domestic product, or GDP, measured at international prices, surpassed that of the United States back in 2014, and is still growing far faster than that of the United States and Europe, making the case for greater exchange rate flexibility increasingly compelling. A more recent argument is that the U.S. dollar's centrality gives the United States government too much access to global transactions information. This is also a major concern in Europe. In principle, dollar transactions could be cleared anywhere in the world, but U.S. banks and clearing houses have a significant natural advantage, because they can be implicitly or explicitly backed by the U.S. Federal Reserve, which has unlimited capacity to issue currency in a crisis. In comparison, any dollar clearing house outside the United States will always be more subject to crises of confidence, a problem with which even the Eurozone has struggled. Moreover, Moreover, former U.S. President Donald Trump's policies to check China's trade dominance are not going away anytime soon. This is one of the few issues on which both Democrats and Republicans broadly agree, and there is little question that trade deglobalization undermines the U.S. dollar. Chinese policymakers face many obstacles in trying to break away from the current renminbi peg, but in characteristic style, they have slowly been laying the groundwork on many fronts. China has been gradually allowing foreign institutional investors to buy renminbi bonds, and in 2016, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, added the renminbi to the basket of major currencies that determines the value of special drawing rights, the IMF's global reserve asset. In addition, the People's Bank of China is far ahead of other major central banks in developing a central bank digital currency. Although currently purely for domestic use, the PBOCs, the People Bank of China's digital currency, ultimately will facilitate the renminbi's international use, especially in countries that gravitate towards China's eventual currency bloc. This will give the Chinese government a window into digital renminbi users' transactions, just as the current system gives the United States a deal of similar information. Will other Asian countries indeed follow China? The United States will certainly push hard to keep as many economies as possible orbiting around the US dollar, but it will be an uphill struggle. Just as the US eclipsed Britain at the end of the 19th century as the world's largest trading country, China long ago surpassed America by the same measure. True, Japan and India may go their own way, but if China makes the renminbi more flexible, it will likely, at the very least, give the currency a weight comparable to that of the US dollar in their foreign exchange reserves. There are striking parallels between Asia's close alignment with the US dollar today and the situation in Europe in the 1960s and the early 1970s. But that era ended with high inflation and the collapse of the post-war Bretton Woods Agreement, the system of fixed exchange rates. Most of Europe then recognized that intra-European trade was more important than trade with the United States. This led to the emergence of a Deutschmark bloc that decades later morphed into the single currency, the euro. This does not mean that the Chinese renminbi will become the global currency overnight. Transitions from one dominant currency to another can take a long time. For example, during the two decades between the First and the Second World Wars, the new entrant, the US dollar, had roughly the same weight in central bank reserves as the British pound, which has been the dominant global currency for more than a century following the Napoleonic Wars in the early 1800s. So what is wrong with the three world currencies? The euro, the renminbi, and the dollar, sharing the spotlight. Nothing, except that neither markets nor policymakers seem remotely prepared for such a transition. US government borrowing rates would almost certainly be affected, though the really big impact might fall on corporate borrowers, especially small and medium-sized firms. Today it seems to be an article of faith among US policymakers and many economists that the world's appetite for the US dollar debt is virtually insatiable. But a modernization of China's exchange rate arrangements could deal the US dollar status a painful blow. Senior Russian diplomat says more countries around the world are joining an initiative to use local currencies for settlement of trade payments, as the US dollar becomes increasingly unreliable because of Washington's sanction policies. In remarks published on Monday, 5th of April, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin said countries in the Asia-Pacific region, including China and Japan, as well as others in Africa and Latin America, have become interested in Moscow's proposal to use non-dollar and local currencies for payment settlements. Alexander Pankin was quoted as saying by the Sputnik news agency, Russia is developing enhanced cooperation on the matter with its partners from the Asia-Pacific region, where the readiness to switch to mutual settlements in national currencies or other currencies apart from the US dollar is quite high. He added that Moscow has been involved in efforts to synchronize its national payment systems with those of China and Japan to facilitate the removal of the US dollar from trade settlements. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister said that switching to non-dollar payments could be implemented in settlements between members of blocs in Eurasia regions, including the EAEU and the CIS. Alexander Pankin said Moscow has been engaged in talks with other major economic and trade blocs around the world, including the BRICS, to promote the issue. Russia has been subject to a series of inclusive American and European sanctions since 2014, when a series of political developments in neighboring Ukraine led to the fall of a pro-Russian government in Kiev. However, Moscow has sought to use the sanctions as an opportunity to distance itself from the US dollar system to minimize the economic impact of the US bans. Russia's central bank has also reduced the share of the greenback in its reserves by switching to other currencies like the euro and the Chinese yuan, or to gold. Russia has already removed the US dollar from dealings with allied countries, including with China and with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Alexander Pankin said central banks in Russia and partner countries, including in the Islamic Republic of Iran, have stepped up efforts to synchronize their financial messaging systems to develop an alternative to the dollar-based SWIFT, a Europe-based clearinghouse for international payments which is highly sensitive to Washington's sanction policies. China's economy has become so big that the Chinese authorities have no option but to distance themselves from the US dollar system. He said the dollar would further collapse once other major economies in Asia, including Japan and India, follow China and give the yuan a weight comparable to that of the US dollar in their foreign exchange reserves. China's ongoing efforts to introduce a digital yuan would further facilitate the currency's international use and would allow China to assume a position like the United States to regulate and monitor global transactions. China's foreign exchange policies in recent years have been a major headache for the United States financial system, whilst Beijing's continuous economic growth has enabled many partner countries to ditch the US dollar from their trade with the rest of the world. China is quickly expanding its economic influence around the world through building new partnerships with other countries. In a fresh blow to the United States' policies to contain its rise, China finalized a 25-year economic partnership agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran recently. The roadmap enables Iran and China to massively expand their trade and economic exchanges in local currencies without the need to rely on the US dollar system to settle their payments.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and how about listening to a prophecy from the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible heir, Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him, when asked by someone whether he was the Qa'im with the truth. I also rise truthfully, but the real Qa'im is he who will remove the enemies of God from earth and will fill it with justice. He shall be my fifth descendant. His absence will be lengthy, during which multitudes will turn away from the faith, while only a few will uphold it.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining me and my wonderful guests on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor and pleasure of having my brothers in faith and humanity join us on today's interesting discussion. To my left, I have the one and only. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Sister Zainab, again, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure
thank
to be with you.
Thank you for joining us, bro.
My name is Brother Yasser. I am from South Africa.
MashaAllah.
I've been here too long. Hope to benefit.
What are you doing here? Why have you been here for so long?
I've been studying in the Islamic seminary for the last 11 years. I'm just finishing my master's.
May Allah increase your tawfiq and prolong Inshallah. Your life. And to my right, I have my special brother and guest. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us.
This is Ayman Rizvi, and I am actually in the Hawza as well for mm-hmm. about 7 to 8 years.
MashaAllah.
Finishing up my second master's program here. I've spent some time in the States as well by working there.
So today I thought we'd talk about the importance of situation and circumstances, because you know the saying that goes, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going, right? And or that you never know how strong you are until being strong is all you can do. It's like when you really don't know what you're made of and the extent of your strength, your willpower, your resilience, your patience, your tolerance, your endurance, even your compassion, until this really critical situation demands you to like put your best self forth, or in some cases your worst self comes out, and then you realize, oh gosh darn it, I'm such a horrible person. I need to up my game. I need to refine myself. I need to become a better individual. So how important do you guys really think the concept of situation and circumstances is, and how many personal experiences have you had from that critical change you had to make based on circumstances?
Well, there is a concept of mustadaf in Islam, which means that you are disadvantaged. If you are in a place, for example, in America or Europe or anywhere for that matter, in which where you have not received the word of God or the word of guidance or the true guidance, for example. Or maybe there is a situation in Africa, maybe there are Wahhabis, you know, they have a madrasa and they are brainwashing children.
Right.
So these are the cases in which you are mustas'af, you are disadvantaged intellectually.
Mm.
But in the cases of children or maybe adolescents, you know, maybe we can say that it's fine. I mean, you know, God will not judge.
They're clueless anyway.
God will not judge them, right?
There's
God
no duty upon them.
But in Western countries, such as in America, I've lived there. I have faced many youths over there. They were, for example, wanting to do the normal things they do, you know, drinking or you know, whatever. And when they asked me and talked to me about that, and I gave them my idea, because Islamic idea or the ethical idea, logically, they understood it. They found it, you know, right. So basically, I think.
It doesn't mean that youth are intellectually impaired. They just don't receive the right guidance and information.
Yeah, they haven't received it yet. Mm-hmm. So I mean, your point was that the situation, right?
Yeah, the situation.
So it's their situation that they haven't gotten the right word or the right knowledge or the right guidance. And when you talk to them about it, you know, human nature, human soul is capable of it.
Mm.
To understand, you know, right from wrong.
Yeah. What do you think about the importance of circumstances?
I think maybe I've understood the question differently to how Sayed has. Sayed is looking at the situation in like the general societal kind of way. I understood the question as being as a person who has a certain type of behavioral characteristic in a certain situation that behavior changes. I don't know which of the questions you were.
Both is fine.
Looking, okay. So I took it meaning that basically that the question that when a person, I know it's one of these things you study in psychology, this behavioral changes in certain situations. I give a simple example that you have two types of personality traits.
Mm-hmm.
One is you have an intrinsic child and the other you have an extrinsic child.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, introvert and extrovert.
Yeah.
One is very silent, one is very outspoken, right? In a specific situation, a child who is introvert will all of a sudden switch and become extrovert because of the situation that is around him at that particular time.
When they're around people that they can vibe with.
Exactly.
Right.
So it depends on the child, all right? For example, that situation can either do two things to that child. It's just an example, right? It can either make that child more introvert, like he's completely dense, completely will get withdrawn, and then that leads to other things.
Right.
Or, you know, join the crowd. Yeah, or join the crowd, basically.
Yeah, right?
So that is one of the things. That's how I understood the question to be like. Examples, you know,
like we have a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam that says, you want to test your brother, make him angry.
Make him
change
angry.
Their circumstances.
Yeah, or like, for example, if you really want to test a person, you know, it's a person who's wealthy, he's not going to be tested. Give him poverty, let's see what he does then. No, that's the reality, right?
Are you still going to be grateful?
Exactly. Are you still going to be thankful? Are you still going to, you know, not even be thankful, not be happy all the time.
true.
You know, be happy all the time.
Posting, living my best.
Exactly.
Life,
you know, you're going to be taking these Instagram photos and stuff that you do now. But I think one of the things is like the one that you, I took as like a person who is very simple. What does Islam say? Well, this is that Islam agrees with that. In certain situations, a person needs to show a certain type of character trait.
Mm.
In ethics, you have three different faculties.
Yeah.
Of anger, lust and shahwiya, qadabiya, I can't remember the last one. I forgot now. There are three faculties basically. So what does it mean is that a person has the ability and a specific situation to either choose one of the two ways. That means that the person is in equilibrium.
Mm.
If he's not in equilibrium, he either be too timid
or
too angry too quickly.
Yeah.
I can't remember the third one right now.
All right, it's okay.
Yeah.
And then?
So this is what Islam and the ethical teachings of Islam says, that, you know, a person should have this ability to, first of all, understand the situation, what that situation calls for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of also the traits of a good manager.
Huh? Come again?
A good manager, for example, in sports teams.
Right.
Like, in a specific situation, you know how to motivate your team.
Okay.
Do you have to shout them at this moment in time? Or do you have to be listening, soft? Now, there are many examples. For example, you have...
Aqlaniya.
Yeah. Aqlaniya.
Shahwaniya, ghadabiya, and aqlaniya.
So, aqlaniya, for example, if a person is too hot-headed, too big-headed, or he's dumb. That's the two sides of it. But that doesn't really show behavioral traits. The other two do, though. Like the lust and the anger show it, because in a certain situation you either go this way or that way, you either too or you too little.
Yeah, exactly.
So the other one is chivalry, or.
But is it safe to say that maybe the world is a really messed up place? And I'm not the only one who's saying this. The angels said it too. God was like, "I'm a create man," and they're like, "They're gonna kill each other though. Why? Right? The world is a really messed up place. It's the trait of the world." Or is it? I'm saying that maybe the world isn't a very messed up place. Maybe it has to be like this. It has to be constantly turbulent, and it has to be a rocky road. It has to be trying and testing all the time so people can really show their essence. If the world was this boring, steady waters, uneventful atmosphere where everything was just like, meh, you know, you could never tell if you are the strong, if you are the resistant, if you are the resilient, if you are the intelligent, compassionate, selfless person that you were really created to be. So maybe there's nothing wrong with the world. Maybe it's supposed to be this way. Am I right?
Yeah, actually, you are right. Because when I was doing my master's program, business administration, I learned that terminology there, SWOT analysis, if you remember. SWOT. So SW basically stands for strengths and weaknesses, which are basically things which can be changed, right?
Yeah.
And there is another aspect, opportunities and threats. So these are the external things, and they cannot be changed.
The way you guys are vibing.
Yeah, we have internal connection.
Alhamdulillah.
So strengths, you know about your strengths.
Yep.
Weaknesses, you also know, are aware of your weakness. If you are not aware, then that's a problem. But if you're aware, if you become aware of your...
That's a good point.
Yeah.
If you're not aware, then that's a problem.
Yeah. If you can become aware of your weaknesses, work on them.
Yep.
Work on your weaknesses, learn new skills, learn new knowledge. As Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam has also said, that a mu'min is the one who learns new thing every day. A person cannot be mu'min unless, you know, he does that. So, but opportunities and threats... don't come every day at your step, right?
Really?
At your step. Yeah, of course. I mean,
what kind of a boring life do you guys live?
Well, maybe small types of
every
opportunities.
Every day, though.
You know, I think you should pray to have a happy life. But you know, what I'm saying that the life is not perfect.
True.
Sometimes they do come. Sometimes they don't.
They don't. Okay. All right.
So if they come, you know, embrace them. If there is a threat, you know, defend yourself from the threat, right? And if there is no threat, that's fine. So, I mean, you have to work on these four. I think it's a great example, I think, the SWOT analysis. You know, if a person works on these four things, half of them are, you know, can be changed. Half of them, you know, you cannot change. You don't have control over. But this is the life in actuality.
Interesting. When was the last time, Brother Yasser, a circumstance or a situation really tried you, and you had to, like, you know, put up a fight, put out your best, or you were knocked down so hard you're like, oh wow, I stink, I'm a horrible person, I need to work on that part of myself?
One of the issues that happened was the sanctions that happened recently.
Yes.
On the university.
Yeah, that hit a lot of people.
So that
hard.
Really, especially us, because the school we were in was hit the hardest because of the students we had.
Were they very international?
Yeah, basically. The school we had was specifically for that type of student. So for like a while, you just lost motivation. What to do and stuff. But alhamdulillah, after a while and stuff, we just said, well, you know what, we here, let's study. Like, there was a group of four of us. So from the four, alhamdulillah, like myself and another brother, we continued and we kind of got to where we are now, so to speak. Oh, just like for 2 months we were going and meeting people, you know.
What were you trying to resolve?
Basically, because you see, this is our last specific term, so being the last term, you have to write your thesis.
Yeah.
right? So we were saying, okay, and we were not sure what was going to happen afterwards, like with the school we were in.
Mm.
What were the circumstances will be? Will the school come back? Will they not come back? Can we wait and see what that happens and so on? Because all of a sudden what happened when the sanctions came, our files got moved all of a sudden without anybody knowing. So we were just transferred.
Am I still the student of the school?
Yeah.
Even?
And so everything just got transferred, everything got closed. And so we went, and after a while we decided, like, no, there's no point wasting time and stuff. We decided
to
just continue.
That is a very good tip.
Yeah.
There's no point wasting time. Just move forward.
Just go and continue. Like, I remember, like, some of the examples that people were giving us, you know, there's no point, like you said, in this why, you know, what's the thing in English? Why cow was spilled milk, they say, right?
True.
Just continue and we move. So that was one of the things that kind of tested us. To say, okay, what do we do? Unfortunately, a lot of brothers, the same, being one of them, being from that particular country, you know, but we all were in that boat.
You're right,
and
right.
A lot of
and what did you feel it brought out in you?
You were
like, oh, I never thought I had it in me. I'm glad now I know.
You have this thing that... this fight or flight response,
mm-hmm.
right? Everybody has that thing, you know. It just shows that, you know, you just put your head down and you work, and you can still continue regardless.
Right.
So, and also one important thing is that, you know, one of the things that is important is to realize that there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. He was asked by somebody, and this is a valuable lesson for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
He says, the person asked him, how do you believe God exists? So the Imam says to him, I know God exists because when I plan to do something, that plan doesn't come up.
Allah, Allah. I swear.
You plan, and then all of a sudden, it's a way, again, like, you either look at it as a humanistic view, and then you're like, oh, you know. But you look at it with the sight of God in front of you, that, no, maybe it was not good for me.
Right.
Maybe Allah had a better plan for me.
Yeah. Thank you so very much for being with us. Thank you to my brothers and guests. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
The Light. Hello there, welcome to the lighter side of the news. It's great to have you with us. Now, cheese goes well with food items indeed, especially on the breakfast table in almost every home. But have you ever tested halloumi? The rubbery cheese I'm talking about from Cyprus, which now gets EU protected status. Halloumi is a traditional homemade item in Cyprus, with historical accounts suggesting its production as early as the 16th century, believe it or not. Now, the salty cheese is the country's second most valuable export. In Turkish, it is known as heli. Europe has now decided to recognize halloumi, called white gold by dairy farmers, as a unique thing to be divided in the eastern Mediterranean island there. Locals usually enjoy it tossed in the frying pan or barbecued, eaten raw with melon in the summer, or cubed and thrown into the boiled with soup.
A baby capybara has found a new family at a zoo in the Colombian city of Cali after she was abandoned by her mother soon after birth last December. The little capybara is 3 months old and is under the care of a surrogate mother who is in charge of providing her with the skills she needs for optimal development. The baby capybara was rejected shortly after birth by her first-time parents. But the zoo hopes that in a couple of months, she will be able to unite with another female of the same species.
As the COVID-19 pandemic has affected affected most sectors in one way or another, the Swiss tech firm has created a robot that can disinfect airplanes in a few minutes. The startup called Uvea says the robot emits powerful ultraviolet lights as it slowly moves down the aisle, killing 99% of bacteria and pathogens, including the coronavirus. The company says a robot can disinfect a single aisle in 13 minutes. The startup co-founder says the UVC technology has been used for decades in hospitals and labs. He says the fact that the rays could be harmful to humans prompted them to seek an autonomous robot that can carry out the task.
It's quite an old technology, but it's quite dangerous. That's why we want to take the worker out of the range of the light. So that's why we made a robot, because there is some solution when you are near the light, and that's dangerous. So we really had to make this system autonomous. So we switch it on, we leave, the machine makes the disinfection, all the plane, all around, and then it stops automatically. So the worker are not in contact with the machine.
The company is hopeful that technology could help restore travelers' confidence in safe air travel and help bring the worst-hit aviation sector back to its feet.
Now, in Egypt, more than 20 ancient royal mummies have been paraded to a new museum to be displayed in Greater Spelman. The mummies include 18 kings and 4 queens who were taken from the Egyptian Museum in central Cairo's Tahrir Square. They were transferred to the National Museum of Egyptian Civilization in Fustat, which lies some 5 kilometers to the southeast of the capital. The ceremony aimed to drum up interest in Egypt's rich collections of antiquities at a time when tourism has entirely stalled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Archaeologists discovered the mummies in 2 batches at a complex of mortuary temples of Deir al-Bahari, located on the west bank of Nile. High-tech light displays at the Beijing International Light Festival provide an immersive experience to visitors and create a miraculous night scene by illuminating the sky. The festival is held in a major urban park in the Chinese capital, Beijing, also a popular site for enjoying cherry blossoms in the spring. As the sun goes down, the park is illuminated with a high-tech light show every evening, and nature's beauty is heightened, it is highlighted with a little help from technology.
The theme of our show this year is blue space. We've created a universe in which there's the blue planet. The visitors come in as explorers from Earth, they board the spacecraft, and it takes them to the blue planet. And the installations they see in the park are different biolandscapes on planet blue. There, they need to complete several tasks, which are the interactive installations we set up. So the exhibition is immersive and interactive.
The exhibition uses 19 different types of lighting equipment to give visitors an unforgettable experience. This is the second year for the Beijing International Light Festival and will last until October 2021.
Painting eggs is a beloved tradition amongst Christians, especially Orthodox, on the occasion of Easter, symbolizing the resurrection of Jesus Christ. A veteran Hungarian artist has taken that craft to a whole new level. 67-year-old Tunde Chuhai has been designing eggs for decades. Each of her delicate creations takes days to make. Chuhai uses various kinds of eggs and says the best one comes from geese. She starts her craft by emptying the eggs through tiny pinholes before washing and then drawing patterns on them. The veteran egg designer says her style is so unique that she doesn't have to sign her eggs.
I never sign my eggs, as everyone knows they were done by me. I don't have to particularly prove that I did it because my style is so distinctive, even though others may use similar techniques.
Chuhai's decorative Easter eggs